Welcome to the fall edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. We once again resume our recordings of one of the longest-running forums in Kansas City at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 45th and Walnut in Kansas City. Every fall and in through the winter, each Sunday they have a series of lectures by distinguished authors and teachers and various other folks. And because of this program, we get to listen in on these learning excursions that we have each week. We're going to start this fall season off with Burdette Loomis, who's a professor of political science at KU, just returned from a long trip to Australia. He's going to talk about how the United States is perceived by other countries. I think it's sometimes good to look at ourselves as others see us. So we'll have about a 40-minute talk from Professor Loomis, and then we'll take a short break, and then we'll come back with a Q&A session to wind up the hour. So without further ado, let's go directly to the introduction, and we'll then hear Professor Loomis.
I'm Michael Duffy, a member of the Forum Committee. Joining us today is Burdette Loomis, who's a professor at the KU Political Science Department, recently returned from Australia as a Fulbright Scholar, and will talk to us today about his perceptions of the American political status from the other side of the world. So please join me in welcoming Burdette Loomis.
Thank you, Michael. And it's great to be here back among Unitarians. See very few. I don't see any. Well, I see one tie. I was getting dressed this morning. I really don't want to put on a coat and tie. And after all, it's the Unitarians. I want to show a little respect. So I pulled out my batik shirt from Indonesia. And when I was in Indonesia about a year ago last May, I arrived, and typical of Indonesia and many of the parts of the world I've been in over the last few years, the average temperature is about 90 degrees, 95 degrees with a very high humidity. And I had my, sort of lightweight suits and everything, and a linen jacket to be cool. But my first advice from the State Department, Indonesian native who accompanied me was, you might want to buy a batik. And if you wear that, they'll like it that you're doing it. And plus, you don't have to wear a jacket. And I said, we're in business. So this is my Indonesian formal dress. I want you to look at the photo on the screen, and if you didn't know any better and didn't know I was going to be talking about being across the world, my bet is your guess would be, oh, that's, somewhere out in central Kansas. That easily could be. I'm sure we could find a grain elevator that looked almost identical someplace out there. But in fact, this is a photo taken from a car driving on the outskirts of Erbil in Kurdistan in Pakistan, in Iraq. But a very, 50 miles away are serious mountains, but near Erbil, it's a plain as flat as the middle of Kansas. So, in a sense, this symbolizes the idea that we're working on many of the same things as I went from a variety of places that I'll talk about. We're often starting at different points, but many of the core questions that face, say, the Kurds in Iraq or Malaysians or whomever, are questions that we have faced in our history and often continue to face, albeit in somewhat different circumstances today. So for the next half hour or so, I want to talk a little about where I've been, how I present the United States, what I've been doing, and then how I reflect back on that, looking at the United States, again, mostly from 10,000 miles away. So that's the title of the talk, da-da-da-da. So this is a map of Asia, and you get a little piece of Australia down in the far right corner. It's the best I could do to encompass every place I have been over the last four and a half years. And let's see if I've got a pointer here. Nah, no pointer. So basically, we'll just list them here. In 2008, I got contacted by the State Department and asked if I wanted to take a trip for them to Malaysia and Singapore. 2008 is an important year because the State Department sends lots of political scientists abroad during American elections. The world, as I'll mention, is fascinated by American presidential elections. And so it's a great time to talk about what's going on in the United States. And you'll see in 2008 and 2009, I actually took five trips. Malaysia, Singapore was one, China was one, Iraq was one, Taiwan was one, and Nepal, Bangladesh was one. Five different trips, two during the campaign in 2008, and then three during the first 8 months of the Obama administration. And it was fascinating as I look back to provide commentaries at different times in the campaign. In 2012, again a presidential year, I spent almost 3 weeks first in Brunei, which is really, really small, and it's a sultancy. There's a Sultan of Brunei who is extraordinarily wealthy, really, really, really wealthy. But even there, in Brunei, which is a monarchy of the first order, there is something called the Legislative Council, which is at least a bow toward democracy. And then I spent 2 weeks in Indonesia, which was really, really fascinating for a whole variety of reasons. And then most recently, January to June of this year, for 5 months, I was a Fulbright Distinguished Chair at Flinders University in Adelaide, Australia. So I had 5 full months in Australia, which gives you, it's obviously a different kind of democracy, far better developed than everything here except for Taiwan, really. But you also got to know the country a lot better, so it gave me a slightly different perspective. I'm doing two things here. Most of my trips are for the State Department's Public Diplomacy Program. And this is a program that is always threatened, and it's cut back, and then it somehow rebounds. I think that senators find sending me abroad or my colleagues or jazz musicians, who often have jazz service later on, they represent the United States in a whole variety of ways. I always say that I may not be smarter than a smart bomb, but I'm cheaper than a smart bomb. And you don't get rich doing this. They pay you some. You travel pretty well because they want to use you. You often give 2 and 3 talks a day for 2 weeks. Usually you get your weekends off, but not always. It's a reasonable trip, but they put you to work. In a previous existence, when I was doing more stuff in the Western Hemisphere, in March of 1992, this is your tax dollars at work, I might say. 1992, presidential year, the United States thought it was the State Department at least, thought it was very important to send somebody to the West Indies to explain American democracy. And so for 10 days, I was in Barbados on the beach. Your tax dollars at work. But I came back from Barbados and a couple of other places out there, St. Lucia and someplace else. God, St. Lucia is beautiful. I didn't really have a tan because I'd go out at 8:30 in the morning and come back at 5:30 in the afternoon. So I could have my rum, Barbados, but I really didn't get a tan. And so I that was my evidence that I had actually been working. When you go on these trips, you're basically trying to explain American politics and democracy, broadly defined, often in the context of a presidential election. And the first thing I would say, I've done this in the first George Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the Bush administration several times, and the Obama administration, nobody has ever told me what to say. No, I've been very critical of the United States in any number of times across all those administrations, probably most notably in the George Bush administration, the second George Bush administration, and talking about the politics of Iraq in particular. And no State Department person has ever said, you ought to tone that down, blah, blah, blah. You don't get in trouble talking about the U.S. You get in trouble when questions come and someone in Malaysia starts talking to you about democracy in Malaysia and what do you think of X or Y or Z, the president doing this or the opposition doing that. And you have to restrain yourself from becoming an expert on Malaysian politics, because that can get you into trouble, because you really don't know what you're saying, even though if you think you do, it's illusionary. So you always turn it back, as some of the things I'll say, to American politics and issues here and how we've gotten over it. More broadly, I think that I'm in the business of enhancing relations with the United States, University of Kansas, political scientists, and various constituencies in other countries. So a lot of it, as you might expect, are university students, university faculty, but you talk a lot to journalists. You talk to various kinds of think tanks. I've talked to the military in various places. Really had some excellent discussions with the military. I'm trying to think of where in Bangladesh, really fascinating, and you end up sometimes making ties, making links with those institutions. I still correspond with several people in Nepal, in Malaysia, and do think I've gained a certain amount of understanding of those countries. But I think the as much as I give, and I'll talk a little bit about this at the end, as much as I'm lecturing or discussing or answering questions about the United States, particularly as you go from one place to another, you really begin to get a context for democracy, small-d democracy, in other nations. And so the teacher often turns out to be the person who learns the most, and I think that's definitely true. In my case, and I feel extraordinarily lucky to have made, you know, 12, 14, 15 of these trips. Got some pictures. This is me making a great faux pas in Brunei. You notice the ambassador next to me with a big grin on his face, and got the students from I think probably a high school. And I'm sitting next to the ambassador and looking very relaxed with my legs crossed. They told me not to cross my legs, but I'm a slow learner. And you can see the ambassador with his hands on his knees. Down. I'm not going to cross my legs, no matter what. Apparently, it wasn't quite as bad as I had been led to think. But it was great fun talking to these students. But I was a little worried that the Sultan might be unhappy with me, or the United States, but I apparently created no diplomatic episode. This is pretty typical of what I'd be doing. This is the U.S. Embassy's sponsor American Corners in libraries all around many, many nations. So this is in a relatively small town, with, I don't remember which one it was, with probably 30 or 40 folks there. Their English was probably pretty good, but not great. But just talking about American politics. And the people who come to the American Corner would generally have reasonably good English. So this would be one of the more informal talks that you'd make. Other times you might be talking to a military college or a think tank where everyone would, you'd have, you know, wonderful venue and PowerPoint and everything, and it varies tremendously, which is a really good thing. Do a lot of TV. On my first trip to China, or my only trip to China, I flew into Beijing, and almost right away I did a Q&A with somebody I went to their office, but they were an online news organization, and as I understand it, after they put my Q&A up on their website, it was within a day or so it was taken down, and it was innocuous. You never know in China. You never knew exactly what websites you'd be able to access in the West. One day you'd be able to get onto Facebook. The next day Facebook would be, you know, you just couldn't find it. You just never knew. It was fascinating because it was a firsthand demonstration of how China is wrestling with the world of the internet and social media, and they want to take advantage of it in a lot of ways. But can you control it? The answer is almost certainly no. So, you know, that you might not think of that as an issue of democracy, but it is. It's a big, you know, information. So, as you go across all these nations, almost all of them are at some point trying to create a democratic state. Now, you know, you go to Taiwan. We'll leave Australia out of it. For the moment, it was really a separate experience. But Taiwan has a well-developed democracy, easily recognizable. Although, if you want some real entertainment, just go to Taiwan Legislature Fistfight, and you will see these battles in the Taiwan Legislature, which evidently are pretty much staged. Because there are all kinds of TV cameras out there, and you've got, you know, think of a small island nation, not too many people, and the equivalent of five or six Fox Newses all wanting pictures. And so, if you want to make a point, you may engage in some kind of physical activity, which ends up roughly being a fist fight. So it's not quite like the U.S. House of Representatives, but sometimes. So one of the things you talk about is it's not easy. This democratization is a struggle. It's hard. It's not an easy process at all. And so no matter what expectations you have, you probably need to be patient. Sometimes that patience may be overwhelming. In Nepal, for example, they've been trying to write a constitution for 8 or 10 years, and I think are still in the process of trying to write it. So even getting the basic agreement on a fundamental document in a place like Nepal is hard. Indonesia, you've had democracy off and on a lot off until 1998, and now, you know, 14, 15 years of democracy, and Indonesians, oh, we need more democracy. You know, how do we do this? And, you know, you got to say, hey, look, the fact that you're as far as you are, that you have political parties, that you have elections that mean something, with a fair amount of corruption as well, it's not bad. You got to keep building. It's never perfect, and we'll talk about that in the context of the United States. And one of the things, I'm a political scientist. I study the Congress, interest groups, the presidency to an extent. And I'm a believer in institutions, even when they're imperfect. And I talk a lot about building institutions, building strong legislative bodies, building administrative capacity, stuff like that, which takes time. So you cut in, and you go to some place like Singapore. Very, very modern, staggering, wealthy. There are no old cars in Singapore. That's another story. But they allegedly have a democracy. But in reality, economic elites run Singapore almost totally. And so they've got democratic issues. They've got to build, at some point, trust democratic institutions to coexist with very, very powerful economic institutions. And right now that trust isn't there. So opposition in Singapore is very, very muted for a whole variety of reasons. Much of it cultural, but also administrative. It's hard to oppose in Singapore. If we have time later, I've got a great Singapore story. I might end the talk with that if we have time. So a whole variety of dimensions. So as I said, you know, Singapore versus Nepal. When I went to Nepal and Bangladesh, I knew something about Bangladesh, and I knew, I'm going to a really poor place. But I went to Nepal first, and that's when I discovered that although Bangladesh was poor, that Nepal was really, really poor. And I think we romanticized Nepal. The mountains, Mount Everest, all this stuff. And there is a lot of Western tourism, but it's an extraordinarily poor nation. And one of the difficulties of creating a constitution in Nepal is tied to the fact that it has very, very little wealth at all. Whereas Singapore is extraordinarily wealthy. You talk about his commitment to democracy. How committed are you really? And this is something you see move from you see it from different from country to country, maybe across time. Are you willing to allow for a peaceful transition of power? That's a pretty crucial kind of indicator. A variety of what's the role of opposition parties? Things like that. And you can tell pretty quickly about that. What's the role of money in politics? Indonesia. It was fascinating to be in Indonesia a year ago because we were talking about Citizens United here and the amount of money in politics and huge amounts of money that's unaccountable. And Indonesia, almost every time I had a question-and-answer session, the first question was, well, what do you do about black money? That was it. In the United States, we now call it dark money. In Indonesia, it was black money. Money that just came out of the private sector into politics, untraceable, often used in one way or another, explicitly for bribery or implicitly. Rural money in politics, extraordinarily important wherever you are. Talked about the peaceful transitions. And then homogeneity. Singapore, pretty homogeneous, at least economically homogeneous. Place like Indonesia, spectacularly diverse. You know, very, very large country, a country of islands, country of varied ethnicity. Malaysia, very diverse, and real Islamic issues. Chinese population issues. So diversity makes a big difference. The more homogeneous, I think, the easier it is for democracy to flourish. One of my favorite places of all to visit, and I still have just the fondest memories, was in Iraq, in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan. And I visited there in 2009. It was extraordinarily safe. I think it's a little less safe now, but it's still a very safe place. I could walk around by myself. There was no problem at this. And this is Iraq, because the Kurds had made it very safe and sort of partitioned it off from the rest of Iraq. And Kurdistan is this mountain peoples. They've been at war in one way or another for decades, if not generations. It was the Kurds who were gassed by Saddam and killed in the tens of thousands. Everybody in Kurdistan had lost somebody in their family. So I traveled with this one couple who'd come back to Kurdistan from southern Iraq, and they said that we're driving up into the mountains. They said, "Oh yeah, my uncle was in those mountains. He was fighting Saddam for 25 years in those mountains." And you go, ah. Another guy who I had hung out with for about 3 days, someone who got a PhD in the United States and was back in Iraq. After, in the third day, he casually mentioned that his father, who was the vice mayor of a town, had been executed by the Ba'ath Party when it came into power in the 1980s. He just mentioned it in conversation. Everybody in Kurdistan had tragedies occur with their family. They were the strongest people I'd ever seen. I mean, remarkable. So I talked to about 30 or 40 members of the Kurdistan Parliament. I was the outside person from New York, from the United States. I was the expert on legislatures and democracy. And so the people came from, and they were dressed from the women in the most modern dress you could imagine to men in very traditional Kurdish garb, with baggy pants. They look right out of a 19th century a photo. You could just tell they've been through a lot, and yet they. So we talked a little bit, and then they said, one after the other said, "Well, what will we do when the Americans leave?" And I was really staggered, because here I saw these people as fiercely independent. They created in Kurdistan a wonderful beginnings of a democratic state. Big universities had grown. The rule of law was reasonably good there. There was economic development. And I just taken it back and said, "Look, we're going to leave. There's no question about it. And you guys have been really successful. You've got to deal with Baghdad and the rest of Iraq. But, I mean, just keep doing what you're doing. The Americans really aren't protecting you. You've created this regional government." These fiercely independent people had become at least somewhat dependent. And in the end, they're going to have to work it out themselves. They have to build their own institutions. But it was again, they learned a little bit, but I learned a lot in that exchange. So you learn a whole variety. You learn what democracy means in a variety of ways. Some places it's procedural. Some places it's more economic. So I'm talking to a bunch of Chinese graduate students and very smart people, very well informed. One of the things that you see in across this region, particularly at universities and with journalists, is that folks have terrific access to information on American politics. So if you're sitting in Indonesia and have decent access to the internet, which most people do, or many people do, you can know as much about the the goings-on about of American politics. I mean, 95% say, as someone sitting in New York or Washington or wherever. I mean, the Internet is very democratizing. So you get people who are well-informed. They can tell you ins and outs of the campaign. Well, why did Obama do this? Or, you know, or Obama versus Hillary. And you got to say, well, there was this. So you could, at the same time, they don't really understand completely all the intricacies of American politics, which is one of my jobs, is kind of fill in a lot of gaps. But you're always in context, one context or another. So Nepal is great illiteracy, very few roads in Nepal. Very difficult to get around. How do you create democracy in that circumstance? Had a massacre of the royal family about 10 years ago. There's still fallout from that. At the same time, one of the things you learn is politicians are politicians. And my favorite place was Brunei, which is a total monarchy. And if the Sultan says X is Y, X is Y. That's the Sultan. And they have created this thing called the Legislative Council. It's got a wonderful building, very nice building. And I visited there. I don't know, I probably asked to visit there, but maybe they took me anyway. And I met with the Speaker of the Legislative Council. And this thing has no real power at all. But the Speaker, he couldn't quite have been lifted from Chicago. But it was close. I won't do any kind of an accent or whatever, but he was this kind of gruff guy that you could see. If there was a legislature, he would have been a hell of a speaker. He would have put John Boehner to shame, which might not be too hard. And I remember talking to politicians, parliamentarians in Indonesia, and as I said, in Nepal. And it's one of my great pleasures is to talk to politicians and to get them talking about what they do and what their problems are. And they've all got problems. And their constituents or their party leaders or whatever. And it really is roughly the same every place if you try to do work in a legislature. The United States is a great example. I love talking about the United States in these contexts 10,000 miles away. You've got the whole question, the whole notion of we've been around for a long time. We are the world's longest established popularly elected democracy. Got that going. But we had a civil war. We've had lots and lots of institutional changes. We've got a contemporary politics that are very hard to understand. Well, why can't Obama just do X or Y or whatever? Or you have a Senate that keeps talking about things and doesn't get anything done, and on and on and on. And you have to explain these unique American institutions. And in particular, I mean, the Electoral College. Over the years, going back to the 1990s, the one most difficult explanation or the most asked for is, what is this Electoral College? And I got to say that that's one thing the Internet's been good for, because there's some pretty good explanations. And so I found in the last few years it's been easier to talk about the Electoral College. And one of the reasons it's great to talk about American politics is that it is this terrific global spectator sport. Particularly for presidential elections, but not just presidential elections. American politics gets covered for a whole variety of reasons, for economic reasons, you name it. Obama certainly is an extraordinarily important element here in recent years. And so what you get is this pretty good understanding of American politics at a superficial level, and even among elites, beyond superficial. At the same time, I mean, they really don't understand a lot of the nature of the separation of powers or federalism, basic building blocks of American politics. They might be able to, you know, identify it on a multiple choice test, but not really understand it. And I'm beginning to get a sense of that myself right now in trying to understand the outcome of the Australian elections, which just occurred yesterday. And in the upper, in the lower house, the parliament, it's pretty easy to understand. Labor lost, the Conservatives, the coalition won. But Australia also has a very powerful Senate that has remarkably obscure and crazy electoral rules. And so trying to understand how the Senate is going to fit with the lower house is really, really difficult. And so, you know, I think I understand quite a bit about Australian politics, but I'm finding out that I probably understand a little less than I did. So I'm going to skip this. I've talked a lot about it. We've talked, you know, you talk about the framers a lot. You talk about conflict, complexity, and the difficulty of governing. And so the United States is deromanticized as much as you can. And look, we've dealt with difficult. So you talk about the framers, but they made a lot of mistakes. They never considered political parties. They devised an electoral college to begin with, which was foolish. But then they devised one that really didn't work. And 10 years after that, they had to fix it after the 1800 election, on and on. A lot of conflict in the United States, Civil War, protests, prohibition, environmentalism, labor, you know, all this. So there is a lot of conflict. And on occasion, and particularly with the Civil War, that conflict was fatal. Talk about the complexity of the system, whether it's the Electoral College or the Senate. Talk a lot about polarization in the United States today. How the parties have moved farther and farther apart. And so if you look at that first graph, you can see the Republicans moving to be more conservative going up, Democrats becoming somewhat more conservative going down. But the black line is the median. And so what the median in the legislature, in the U.S. Congress, that sharp rise, that's the election of 2010 that brought all the Tea Party people in. And so not only are you polarized, but you have, as Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein have said, have sort of gone off a cliff on the right-hand side of American politics. Now, trying to explain that is hard. It's hard in the United States, but it's I think trying to talk about how our own institutions, the legislature in particular, doesn't really fit with this growing polarization and obstructionism in American politics. That is a real challenge, and it's one thing that I think is really important that people around the world understand. Still, overall, the United States, from 10,000 miles, it always happens, even in this environment with this Congress that is so dysfunctional. We've been flexible over the years. We've had this great longevity, often due to the flexibility of the Constitution and the ability to modify it to an extent. We have peaceful transitions, even though there are people who would probably want to impeach Clinton. They'd like to impeach Obama. Probably some people would like to have impeached George W. Bush. So there's always an underlying set of problems. For the most part, partisanship has been restrained. Maybe not so much right now. One of the things you discover in Australia, I discovered, is the American system of government is pretty transparent. We know a lot about lobbying. We know quite a bit about campaign contributions. In the wake of Citizens United, there are increasing problem areas of big money, usually rich people, not corporations, but rich individuals or private corporations, the Kochs. giving a lot of money anonymously. That is an issue. But overall, transparency is pretty high. And we're pretty good at accommodating diversity. We're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. So what have I learned? Well, first of all, I found out that I love mountain peoples. I love the Kurds and the Nepalese. They're fantastic. They're the most resilient people, unbelievable, and characters, too. They're just tough. Great fun. Not so functional, but great fun. I also learned that I love the beach, and you'll see that in a second. I got to live in Australia on the beach for someone from Kansas for 5 months. Not near the beach, on the beach for 5 months. I learned that learning a little bit about nations and cultures, it really is dangerous. You come in after you talk to a few people for a while, particularly in the State Department, you think you know a lot, and you really don't know anything. And that's really dangerous. To answer those questions, so about from a Chinese or an Indonesian or a Nepalese on their politics, so you steer back and in the United States we've had a lot of conflict. And as I said, for all I taught, and overall I've learned so much more. I'm an American politics specialist, and so it's been this great gift for me to be able to make these 10 or 15 trips over 20 years, and particularly the ones in the last 5 years, to places that I'd never been, only heard of. It's been spectacular, and I really do think it informs me as a scholar here in what I do in the remainder of my career, and just how I think about politics. So I'll end with three pictures. This is my commuting in Nepal. Going from you fly into Kathmandu in a large airplane, but any place within Nepal, these kind of workhorse double engine planes are what get you around. And I just love the idea of flying on Buddha Air. It was August when I was in Nepal, and I never saw the mountains. I was there for 10 days, never saw the mountains. Only when I flew above the clouds did I see a few peaks. They said, come back in October. It will be clear then. This is very close to where I lived in Australia. And these are the surf rescue kids. And every town, Australia isn't just one big beach, really. And every town has its surf rescue groups, a volunteer organization, usually with a pretty decent restaurant and bar in their club. But they're centered around this idea of rescuing people. Well, Adelaide's not very, the surf isn't very serious. It's a huge, huge bay. Go to Sydney. Much more serious. People are lost there all the time. But they begin very young. And my wife just became enthralled by the nippers, the littlest kids. These are probably six-year-olds going off in 60-degree surf, going off to paddle their boards and swim in the middle of the winter. They were just fantastic. You could see them running up and down the beach. They have contests. It was great. This is the view I got to see every night. I have more sunset pictures than you can possibly imagine. I never got tired of them. It's a little self-indulgent, but it was great to be living in a little community for 5 months and getting to know a lot of people in a variety of ways. That's something you can't do when you travel for the State Department. So that's my story. It's been a great ride. I hope to do some more of these trips. I hope that I've done some good for the United States. I can only think of one minor diplomatic episode, and that's when I insulted the French at some place. And the State Department people sort of shrugged and said, well, it's only the French. So what the heck. Now I got to finish with one story, and this is from Singapore, and it might be my favorite story of the last 5 years of traveling. Have any of you been in Singapore? So Singapore is what I call soft fascism. Everybody knows what you're doing there. It's very wealthy. The hotels are spectacularly good. Everything works in Singapore. You know, the roads are great. It's small and wealthy. So I was in Singapore. I was finishing up my trip. And I'd done three lectures that day. It was, you know, 95 degrees, 80% humidity. I was done. 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I walked into the botanical gardens that were next to the hotel, near the hotel. Really nice. And I'm walking along, and Singapore is just perfect. You know, it's all clean. You get picked up if you're arrested if you chew gum and throw it out. You know, that, all those stores. Anyway, I'm walking in the botanical gardens, and 10 minutes in, I come around a corner, and there on a park bench, I've been there 2.5 days. My mindset was already 2.5 days. There on a park bench was a soda can. You know, 12-ounce soda can, a Coke can or something. So in the next 5 seconds, I have three thoughts. The first thought is, who could have possibly done that? No. My first thought was, oh, my God, look at that. What a mess. One cup up. Secondly, who could have possibly done that? Looking, you know. Third thought, is this a trap? And I immediately just kept on walking. So that was my sense of Singapore, that there was a lot of control, even though you never saw it. Much of the control was in your own head. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Professor Burdette Loomis here on KKFI's All Souls Forum today. We've got a few messages of import for you. Let's do those, and then we'll come back, and we'll have the question and answer session from the audience. The audience has a few questions they'd like to ask the professor, so we'll listen in on that after we hear these words.
Did you know that you can donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling 866-628-628. 2277.
Mr. Loomis, I want to thank you for being here with us this morning. I'm not sure I understood what the purpose of most of your trips was, but I thought it probably was to number one, to generate better understanding and favorable feelings toward the United States, and two, but possibly to give advice and information that that people in these countries, leaders especially, could use. And I feel like there might be a lot. Maybe you could give us just one or two examples of how you were helpful in either or both of those categories, because I think we have gotten an interesting picture of how enjoyable your trips were, but not so much what the impact was.
Yeah, I think it's easier to quantify the enjoyment as opposed to the impact. My guess is that the State Department's public diplomacy program would argue that no one visit by one professor or musical group or historian or English professor or governmental official or whatever on one of these tours has all that much impact. But the sum total is to provide a very broad notion of what the United States is really like. I do think that in these elections that people came away from my talks understanding how we select a president, how it's not just the total number of votes, how the Electoral College, how the complexity of it. I'll give you one good example, I think, as the election wore on in 2008, and it was particularly so after it was obvious that Obama was going to get the nomination in China, and then afterwards, after he'd won the election, people said, aha, the United States was willing to nominate and then elect a black man, but not a woman. So that must mean that African Americans, are a favored class relative to, even to women. And I said, no. Obama ran a better campaign than Hillary did. Hillary easily could have become the nominee. If she had become the nominee, she would have won the election in a very similar way to Obama. But so I think there are correctives there. And I also think there's correctives in terms of the institutions themselves. And really going back to the framers of the Constitution and saying, look, they tried to divide power up because they distrusted power. So those are the kinds of things that I think are useful. On the advice side, it's much harder. As I say, it gets pretty dicey when you start to give advice about procedures in a given country. And so you tend to be more general. If I had a general piece of advice that I talked about over and over again, as I mentioned, it's that building institutions takes time. You can't hope to be perfect or close to be perfect soon or quickly. You really have to work at it and things, make institutions better, make the electoral process better, on and on. So there's a kind of gradualism that occurred in the United States because we've been at this now for 225 years. So it's a kind of continuing experimentation. So that's the level at which I would, and occasionally there might be something where I would say, this might work a little better than that. But that's really not my role. My role was much more the former in your question than the latter. Yeah.
Your experiences that you so well explained and demonstrated makes me think a little bit about how did England, before World War II, for 200 years and more, dominated that whole area of 2 or 3 billion people and was able to manage to be the number one country in the world without trying to instill democracy as we try to do, but more or less trying to dominate the area. Now, comparing that period with what you have demonstrated, and are we getting impatient that we're trying to instill democracy in 50 years when England did it for 300.
Yeah, okay. I'm not an historian, but the last part, where you got to is really an excellent question. I think in some ways that we have to learn from these nations and these peoples as they democratize, and not have such high expectations. That doesn't mean that you, and we're seeing this in Syria and other places, that's extraordinarily difficult, and I'm not going to offer, I'm pretty usually quite forthright in opinions. I will offer no opinion on Syria, zero, because I think it illustrates the point that you're making, that there is this great amount of complexity. We run into peoples that are where democracy might mean something very different, and so something like Afghanistan. So importing or exporting, and we've never been very good at exporting American-style democracy. Notice, no country in the world has a Senate like the United States. No country in the world has adopted an electoral college. Key parts of our system, people look at and say, no thanks. I think that we have to have a really broad and long-term approach to the idea of small-term democracy. Yeah, I think that's right.
In your travels and your analysis of all these different countries, did you find any recognition of the existence of an international setup like the United Nations?
That's an interesting question. I don't think we talked much about the United Nations. It did not come up very, very much. Because I was often coming back to the United States as my point of reference. I do think that if I'd have been in Africa, places where the UN may have been had more of a presence, that it might have popped up somewhat more. I do think that there is, again, via the internet and media now, a real international understanding of in a country, you know, even a poor country like Nepal, of the rest of the world. And so even though the whole Arab Spring thing didn't turn out quite how, you know, we might have wanted or we might have thought it was going to, certainly the power of example is really strong. And so I'd say that's a more the international element than the institution of the United Nations.
I'd like to get an idea of the kinds of questions that you are asked when you are speaking to various groups. Are these people screened beforehand and instructed not to ask, like, really nasty questions?
No.
Or do you get some what you would consider to be embarrassing or aggressive questioning during your travels?
There might be some screening. It's more informal. I'd be going to a school that is, you know, where they're, you know, the English is good and stuff like that. But I talk to a lot of journalists who can be quite aggressive in certain ways. Often you'll end up having basically a Marxist perspective question coming on about Americans and their imperialism and stuff like that. And it's not really that hard to deflect it. A lot of the questions, though, do come from, and these really are unmediated questions about the circumstances in a given place, whether it was Malaysia or Indonesia or Bangladesh or whatever, and how they could do X or Y or Z. And I'd often have to say, well, I'm not an expert in Bangladesh or whatever, but here are some of the ways that the American experience relates to your question. I'd say half the questions came out of were not so much on American politics as how does the broad notion of democracy and governance in our country relate to that of the United States. And I think over the years I've gotten pretty good at making that segue without offending the government. I'm perfectly happy to offend the American government. It's not my business to offend the government of the place that I'm saying. Thanks very much.
You're listening to Professor Burdette Loomis talk about the perception of America from outside of America. This show was recorded at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We want to thank Rita Norton for her help in coordinating these shows, and the staff at All Souls who provides us with the recordings that we use each week. This program was produced and edited for broadcast by Barry Lee. We hope you tune in again next week for another edition of the All Souls Forum. Here on KKFI, you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Funding for KKFI provided by the weekly forum at All Souls UU Church. Each Sunday at 10 a.m., the forum will feature a discussion on community issues. All Souls UU Church is at 4501 Walnut Street, one block east of Main in Kansas City. More information is at allsoulskc.org.